Hey guys, just letting you know, I had some issues with Ashley's mic from minute 15 to minute 38. I fixed it the best I could, and from now on I'll pay attention more to the audio when recording. Hopefully you guys enjoy.
Don't be afraid of the dark. Just relax and let the darkness fall over you.
Welcome to Afraidish, a podcast where every four episodes we venture into a new state and take a deep dive into the history and paranormal while enjoying some tasty adult beverages. From ghost sightings to hauntings, urban legends and cryptids, let's get weird and afraidish together. Hello and welcome to episode 10 or episode 2 in Kentucky of Kentucky. I'm Paul Branham.
And I'm Ashley Branham.
And
Yeah.
Another episode.
Yay!
We made it.
Maybe.
So, what have we been up to?
Working,
and we did go on a date night.
Yeah, we did.
We saw Michael Winslow at the Blue Room Comedy Club in Springfield.
Yeah, that was...
Oh my gosh, that was...
Awesome.
So fun. He was on top of his game.
My God. It was so funny. Like, I had to work the next day. We went on a Saturday night and I work on Sundays. And I showed up for work the next day and I had to tell my clients, like, I'm not sick. I just was up all night screaming and laughing my ass off.
Yeah. He was so hilarious.
Yeah, it was really good. For any of you that don't know who Michael Winslow is, he is a comedian. He was in the Police Academy movies.
Yes.
And he had a cameo in Spaceballs. He's the guy that makes all the funky noises with his mouth.
Yes.
I'm not even going to attempt it because I can't do it.
He basically did the music and sang as Prince.
Yeah.
During his stand-up, and he did...
Jesus Christ.
So much. Oh, my goodness. He did Prince. He did
Jimi Hendrix.
Jimi Hendrix. He did the guitar noises. Oh, my God.
He did Led Zeppelin.
Led Zeppelin.
He did...
The one with Stevie Nicks.
Did he do Fleetwood Mac?
He did Fleetwood
Mac. Oh, he did do Fleetwood Mac. He did David Bowie.
Yes.
Anyway, it was...
It was so fun.
It was amazing. It was so fun. And the drinks weren't bad either.
No.
They are not stingy with their liquor.
Yeah, and they're in a brand new location, which is a bit bigger than the small room at the billiards place.
Yeah. They seem to... The pandemic hit them hard, I think, in the beginning. Yeah. And then once they kind of got through the roughest patch, it really picked up for them.
So if you guys want to see a stand-up comic, go to the Blue Room Comedy Club in Springfield. It's a lot of fun.
This podcast is not sponsored by them. They don't know who we are. We just like to talk about local places.
Yeah. So let's go ahead and get into another five fun facts about Kentucky.
Woo!
So, number one, the fast food giant KFC originated in Kentucky on September 24th, 1952. Today it is the world's second largest fast food chain with over 20,000 branches across the globe. Above all, its acronym KFC, Kentucky Fried Chicken, has been there from the very start and will carry on its legacy as a homegrown trademark. Colonel Harlan David Sanders founded KFC in North Cornyn, Kentucky. The famous icon or logo of KFC is the picture of the owner himself. The legacy of Colonel Sanders continues even after his death. To illustrate, by the time of Sanders' death, on December 16th, 1980, there were only 6,000 KFC branches.
Wow. Fun fact about me, KFC is probably my least favorite fast food place. Chick-fil-A is my first least favorite fast food place. True. KFC is a very solid second. I hate their food.
Anyways, it's just a fun fact. Number two, Thunder over Louisville is the opening ceremony for the Kentucky Derby Festival and is North America's largest annual fireworks display.
Wow.
So some people say Louisville.
It's Louisville. If you talk to anybody from Kentucky, it's Louisville.
Yeah. Number three, the world's first enamel bathtub was manufactured in Louisville in 1856.
Okay.
Number four, since 1981, every Corvette that's been produced was built at the Bowling Green Assembly Plant in Bowling Green, Kentucky.
I did not know that.
Yeah. You can catch a glimpse at some of the oldest, rarest, and most unique at the National Corvette Museum just across the street from the assembly plant.
Wow.
And that would be a fun thing to go see, I think. Number five, the World Peace Bell, which is one of the largest free-swinging bells in the world, is displayed in Newport, Kentucky.
I did not know that.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. I feel like bells.
Yeah.
And always, whenever I hear bell, it reminds me of the episode of New Girl with Winston and his bells.
I haven't seen all that, so just parts of when you were watching it. So.
Yeah. Apparently I'm behind. I need to catch up.
Yeah. Now let's go ahead and get into my story. Let's travel to the most haunted nightclub in America. Let's get into the history of Bobby Mackey's Music World, located at 44 Licking Pike in Wilder, Kentucky.
I'm familiar with Bobby Mackey's.
Yeah. In 1850, on the outskirts of Wilder, Kentucky, a large slaughterhouse and meatpacking facility was constructed to serve northwestern Kentucky and nearby Cincinnati, Ohio. In the lowest part of the building, a well was dug and used to hold the blood, guts, and waste from the slaughtered animals. Some researchers have speculated that after the slaughterhouse closed in the 1890s, satanic cult activity took place in the building around the well. Animals and possibly humans were being slaughtered here for ritualistic purposes during secret meetings. In 1896, one of the most horrific and gruesome murders happened in the area, the murder and beheading of 22-year-old Pearl Bryan. Her body was found just 2 miles from the slaughterhouse.
Wow.
Let's talk a little bit about Pearl Bryan. Pearl Bryan was born on October 25th, 1872 in Greencastle, Indiana. She was the 11th of 12 children.
Fuck.
Yeah, I know. Born.
No, thank
That's a
you.
Lot. She was the 11th of 12 children born to Alexander and Susan Bryan. Alexander was a successful stock breeder and dairy operator. The Bryan family was well-to-do and traveled in the most elite social circles of their community.
Huh.
So, a well-to-do white girl.
Yep.
So.
But it made national news when it happened.
Probably. The people of Greencastle found 20-year-old Pearl pretty and charming. A newcomer to the town was especially fond of her, 27-year-old aspiring dentist Scott Jackson. He and his mother, Sarah, moved to Greencastle in 1895 after Scott ran into trouble with embezzling from his college.
It's always the white dudes.
Yeah. Scott formed a friendship with William Wood, Pearl's cousin. William introduced Scott to his pretty single cousin. The two formed an intimate relationship, and Pearl became pregnant by the end of summer.
Oh.
Pearl wanted desperately to marry Scott and have their baby, but Scott said no. He was on his way back to college and expressed to Pearl that she needed to have an abortion. Scott returned to college, and Pearl kept her condition, quote, condition, secret. Scott wrote letters to William with messages for Pearl. These were not expressions of love, but instructions and recipes meant to induce a miscarriage. Pearl wrote back to explain the methods weren't working. Pearl was beginning to show when Scott visited for Christmas. He knew something needed to be done quickly. He asked Pearl to arrange a trip to Cincinnati where he would, quote, take care of her. We all know what that means.
Mm-hmm.
Pearl believed Scott would marry her in Cincinnati. She told her family she was going to visit the Fisher family in Indianapolis. Instead, she set off for Cincinnati on January 28, 1896. Pearl arrived in Cincinnati and went to the Ohio College of Dental Surgery to find her beau. Unable to locate Scott, Pearl rented a room in the Indiana house in downtown Cincinnati under her sister's name, Mrs. Maud Stanley. She located Scott via messenger, and the two made plans to meet. Scott arrived with his roommate, Alonzo Walling. Scott let Pearl know he had no plans to marry her. The purpose of the visit was to terminate her pregnancy. An employee of a downtown business told investigators that on January 30th, 1896, he saw Pearl, Scott, and Alonzo eating lunch. He heard Pearl say, "I'm going back to my home, and Scott Jackson, you will have to answer to my brother Fred for this." Those were the last words ever heard from Pearl Bryan. February 1st, 1896, 17-year-old Johnny Hewling was on his way to Locke Farm in Fort Thomas, Kentucky, where he worked as a farmhand. As he tried to keep warm, he stumbled over the headless body of a woman. The terrified boy ran to his employer, who immediately sent for the police. The first officials on the scene were Sheriff John Plummer and County Coroner Tingley. Townsfolk flocked to the Locke Farm in droves to catch a morbid glimpse of the deceased, which I'm assuming screwed up the whole scene for the investigators and stuff, like they always did in the back then. And
right.
Kentucky investigators thought the woman was a prostitute from Cincinnati. They called detectives Cal Krim and Jack McDermott, who kept track of Cincinnati brothels and the girls who worked them. Neither recognized the deceased woman. The woman lay on her chest, head down, on the slope of a ravine. Her arms were outstretched, and her feet rested at the top of the hill in a pool of blood. Drops of blood splattered across the leaves of private bushes above. Krim located a woman's number 8 shoe on top of the bank and a few strands of blonde hair. She wore a light blue checkered dress, a dark blue skirt, and union suit underwear. On her hands were tan-colored kid gloves, sliced open from grabbing a knife blade. Officers noted that she was shabbily dressed, aside from her new shoes, and of exceptional quality. The deep wounds on her hands and arms indicated that she put up one hell of a fight. Bloodhounds tracked the murderer's scent to a nearby reservoir. Figuring the murderer threw the head in there, police had it dragged along with two pawns. In each case, they came up empty-handed. Dr. Robert Carruthers performed an autopsy that Monday, which revealed the murderer decapitated Pearl with a dissecting knife. The crime scene was so bloody, the doctor surmised that her heart was still a beat when her head was severed. The woman appeared to be around 5 months pregnant. Her fetus was removed and taken to New York for preservation. Sometimes before she died, she ingested large quantities of cocaine that Scott gave her, hoping to kill her fetus. Dr. Carruthers drew this conclusion. "I am satisfied that the girl was not outraged." I think he meant raped, he said. "The man had a reason to kill her, and the result of the postmortem shows it. I judge that it was a premeditated and cold-blooded murder. The girl, in my opinion, was from the country and was comparatively innocent. She was brought to Cincinnati to submit to a criminal operation. Once here, she was taken to Fort Thomas and murdered. Her head was taken away, horrible as it may seem, merely to prevent the identification of her body." So, I'm not going to go through the trial, but basically, Scott and Alonzo were executed for the murder of Pearl Bryan on March 20th, 1897.
Wow.
The location of Pearl's head is still a mystery.
Ugh.
Yeah. Alonzo and Scott were dental students who practiced on cadavers, which were not easy to come by. In likelihood, Scott sold the anonymous head to his college. Perhaps he used the campus furnace to cremate it. We can only guess.
Hmm.
Pearl Bryan has become the stuff of legends. Ballads have been written in her honor. She became part of the satanic panic in the 1980s and 90s.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
When her head, when rumors flew that Alonzo used her head to worship the devil at what is now Bobby Mackey's in Wilder, Kentucky. Her supposed haunting of Bobby Mackey's continues to attract ghost hunters worldwide. So, I guess since then people have went to the well before Bobby Mackey's opened, and you know, the whole satanic thing.
Because it's gotta be Satan.
Yeah. The slaughterhouse was demolished in the early part of the 20th century, and the lot sat empty until the 1920s, when a new building was erected that served as a casino, nightclub, and speakeasy during the Prohibition. When Prohibition ended in 1933, E.A. Buck Brady bought the building and named it the Primrose. After more than a decade of successful operation, his casino caught the attention of Cincinnati mobsters who tried to muscle their way into the operation.
Of course.
Yes. When Brady refused to sell, the violence escalated with fighting and threats to customers in the parking lot until Buck drew a gun on a mobster named Albert Red Masterson and was charged with attempted murder and left the casino business in 1946. Hmm. The building reopened as a nightclub called the Latin Quarter in the 1950s. Johanna, who was said to wear rose-scented perfume, a dance hall girl, and the daughter of the nightclub's owner, fell in love with a singer, Robert Randall, who performed there. She got pregnant and intended to run off with the young singer, but her father forbade the romance and used his criminal connection to have the singer killed. When Johanna discovered what had happened, she poisoned her father, then took her own life in the basement of the building.
Ugh.
Yeah. Fun fact, Bobby Mackey's full name is Robert Randall Mackey.
Okay.
Not the same guy, obviously, but...
Right.
I don't know. In 1978, after a series of fatal shootings at the Rough and Tumble nightclub, the local authorities were forced to close the establishment. Later that same year, 1978, a young country singer named Bobby Mackey purchased the building and turned it into the music hall and tavern that still stands today. Paranormal phenomena have been present since day one, though Bobby himself is skeptical. He'll admit that he doesn't doubt the word of a family member, employees, police officers, and patrons who have experienced strange activity. Both the clergy and psychics have tried to help, but a dark force still seems to linger. And here are some paranormal happenings still reported. Some still believe the building's basement holds the gateway or portal to hell itself, a reference to the long-abandoned slaughterhouse well. Stairs near the well in the old slaughterhouse have been deemed the stairs that lead to nowhere. Phantom footsteps can often be heard on these stairs.
Were the stairs part of the original slaughterhouse?
Yes. Yeah. Huh?
So they built the bar on...
Well, there was like a wood flooring that went up so high above the well. So I'm assuming those steps were next to the well that led to, in that case, nowhere.
I guess I just thought that when they demolished the slaughterhouse, they demolished it, you know?
Well, the well stayed. They just filled it in with rocks and stuff.
Okay.
Some believe that spirits can't cross flowing water, so the rare northern current of the Licking River may be keeping the dark forces trapped inside the building.
They're supernatural beings. They can't cross flowing water?
Well, I don't know. The power of flowing water, I guess. I have
limitations white people put on the supernatural. Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm sorry.
I don't know.
Fucking scary.
Yeah. A former caretaker that lived in the apartment upstairs claims to have been demonically possessed by the spirits. His exorcism was performed in the nightclub by a minister. He's the one that actually, I might talk about in a few minutes, but he's the one that found the well by being, quote, possessed and hammering the floor until it made a hole and he found the well under the floor. A patron claims to have experienced suffocating heat, a flying trash can, and a man with a handlebar mustache repeating, die game, in the men's restroom. Okay, this article says it's Latin for dying well or dying good, but my research says it means the day of the game, if it is actually Latin. So who knows? I don't know.
I'm assuming an American, Caucasian right. ghost in America.
Either that here, or that he wants to play the die game, like rolling dice. Yeah.
Right.
I don't know. Bobby's first wife, Janet, claimed before her passing in 2009 to have been overcome by the scent of roses in the basement, grabbed around the waist, picked up, thrown down, and pushed downstairs by a force that resembled sketches of Alonzo Walling screaming, "Get out! Get out!" She refused to set foot in the nightclub by herself again. Bobby Mackey claims not to be a believer, but he did write a song entitled Johanna about the young girl who died by suicide in the basement in the 1950s. Bobby Mackey's friend Doug Hensley wrote the book Hell's Gate, which connects the events of the past with the hauntings of the present. Historic photos of Pearl Bryant match witnesses, descriptions of a headless ghost dressed in turn-of-the-century clothing, and photos of Buck Brady also match descriptions of often-seen ghosts. Huh. Hot spots in the club include the spotlight room and catwalk over the stage, the well in the basement, the old china room, and the platform area near the kitchen. People have also claimed to see ghosts in the big pitted mirror in the main room. The club manager claims that on several occasions, she would go through the club and make sure everything was turned off and closed down for the night. Then hours later, she'd find that the bar lights were on, the front doors were unlocked, and the jukebox would be playing the anniversary waltz, even though the jukebox was still unplugged and did contain that song.
Did?
It did contain it, but it was unplugged. It's crazy. Another club employee has seen a dark, very angry man behind the bar in a spirit who called herself Johanna. She would often speak to him and leave the scent of roses in her wake. There are a few more paranormal stories. In the mid-1990s, a car shot down Licking Road, lost control, and smashed into a telephone pole just outside the club's front door. Larry Hornsby was the first policeman at the scene. As he stood there, looking over the wreckage, a woman dressed in an evening gown came out of the club and offered him a pair of tablecloths to lay over the faces of the dead. The next week, Hornsby came by to thank her. The club, he learned, had been locked and no such woman existed. J.R. Costigan, a bar regular fond of Western-style clothing and ice water in equal measure, reported an attack in the men's bathroom at Bobby Mackey's. While washing his hands, he looked in the mirror, and there it was, a man-shaped hole in the air, complete with a cowboy hat. It came at him, punching, kicking, clawing, beating him until he fainted. Upon recovery, he ran straight to Bobby and told him he had to get control of his club's evil spirits. Bobby laughed, assuming it was a joke, but Costigan wasn't laughing. He sued Bobby for negligence in allowing the ghost to operate without any warnings to patrons.
What?
Yeah, so he tried to sue Bobby for ghost negligence.
Well.
The judge threw the case out.
Obviously.
Recommending that Costigan take the matter up with a higher power. Following the advice of his lawyer, Bobby put up a warning sign in the front entrance. The ghost, by all accounts, remains in the commode. In 2008, the premiere episode of the Travel Channel's reality show Ghost Adventures features an investigation at Bobby Mackey's Music World. The Ghost Adventures crew, including show host Zach Bagans, is an aggressively masculine take on the profession of a ghost hunter.
Yeah.
Their style is combative. They, quote, provoke ghosts by shouting at them, insulting them, daring them to come out and show themselves. The Bobby Mackey episode is a mishmash of interviews with Lawson and Hensley, intercut with scenes of the three main hunters fumbling around in the dark basement, using night vision cameras, and swearing at specters.
That is the most accurate description yes. of Ghost Adventures I've fucking ever heard.
Yep.
Aggressively masculine. While wearing bedazzled jeans.
Yes. Eventually, Zach Bagans received several long scratches, allegedly, from a phantom hand, and the crew went home happy. The episode was successful enough to spawn two sequels, including a web series, Return to Bobby Mackey's, and another episode in 2010. All three proved wildly popular. Visits to Bobby Mackey's by a paranormal enthusiast had lagged a bit and then rocketed back up and have not come back down since then.
Since the airing of these episodes?
Yes. These days, however, ghost investigations at Bobby Mackey's Music World are handled by Gatekeeper Paranormal, the club's resident supernatural investigators.
So do they not let other people come in and investigate?
I don't think so. The Gatekeeper Paranormal team is comprised of four women from around Cincinnati and northern Kentucky: Laurel Roland, Angela Johnson, Mandy Loftus, and Kim Short. Since 2014, they've been leading two-hour ghost tours on weekdays, along with the occasional five-hour investigation.
Oh, so you
so basically,
pay them to
yeah.
Gatekeeper is right.
There you go. That's how you make the money.
Leave it to the white ladies.
Yeah. If you decide to visit this honky tonk bar, which is only open Friday and Saturday nights from 7 p.m. to 2 a.m., make sure you read the sign in front of that says, "Warning to our patrons, this establishment is purported to be haunted. Management is not responsible and cannot be held liable for any actions of any ghosts / spirits on these premises. Come for the ghosts, stay for the music," as Bobby Mackey says. If you encountered a spirit at Bobby Mackey's Music World, would it make you afraid-ish?
I mean, I wouldn't want to be beat up by a ghost in a men's bathroom, that's for sure.
That would be rough. So, what's the secret story you have that I haven't heard yet?
Well, what's funny is it shares a name with somebody in your story. We'll get to that eventually.
Oh, sweet.
Alright, so my story tonight is on the Seelbach Hotel in Louisville, Kentucky. The Seelbach was, and I don't know if I'm saying that exactly correctly, I'm not sure. It was founded in 1905 by the Seelbach brothers. The Seelbach Hotel was once one of the grandest hotels in America and is now listed on the historic registry. Louis Seelbach immigrated from Bavaria in Germany in 1869, and in 1874 he opened the Seelbach Bar and Grill, which became a very fast success. Eventually he was able to afford to move his brother Otto from Bavaria to Kentucky, and together they built some lodging on top of the bar and grill. But they had a dream of building a hotel as opulent as the finest in Europe. And in December of 1903, they broke ground. And in May of 1905, they celebrated the hotel's grand opening. On opening day, May 1st, 1905, 25,000 people attended the Grand Gala. Dinner parties were hosted in all 158 rooms, and the hotel became an immediate success, so much so that by January of 1907, they opened a 350-room expansion. So the grand total of all the rooms was now 500.
Dang.
In 1925, Louis Seelbach passed away, leaving a need for new management. In 1926, the Chicago-based businessman Abram M. Laban purchased the property for approximately $2.5 million, the equivalent to $38,639,406 today's money.
Damn.
He later sold it to the Epley Company for $2 million, a loss of approximately $8 million in today's money.
Dang.
In 1956, Mr. Epley, based in Omaha, Nebraska, sold the hotel and more of his other properties to the Sheraton Company in the second largest hotel sale in U.S. history to date. They would go on to change the name of the hotel to the Sheraton Seelbach Hotel, and then later they dropped the Seelbach and it just became the Sheraton Hotel. In 1968, Sheraton sold the hotel to the Gotham Hotels Company, who ended up changing the name back to the Seelbach Hotel. And then in 1975, the owners of Gotham Hotels went bankrupt, causing most of their properties to either have to be sold or closed. The Seelbach was one that was closed. In 1978, Louisville native Roger Davis purchased the hotel and began restoration work. The hotel has since changed hands many more times, but is currently a member of the Hilton family.
Nice.
Over the course of its 116-year history, the hotel has hosted many guests, from everyday people like us, business people, lovers, famous faces, and some of the most infamous criminals in American history.
Nice.
F. Scott Fitzgerald was a frequent guest of the Seelbach in the spring of 1918 while he was training for his deployment to Europe during World War I. I don't believe he actually rented rooms at the hotel. I think he liked to frequent the bar. One of his favorite spots in the hotel was the Rathskeller Room, which is a Bavarian-inspired tavern in the basement. One night, a drunken F. Scott Fitzgerald had to be restrained and was eventually ejected from the property. Fortunately, that didn't seem to dampen his fondness for the old Seelbach, as it seems to have been the inspiration for the venue that played host to Tom and Daisy's wedding in The Great Gatsby. Tom rented the entire floor of the Malbach Hotel. Some people speculate whether that was the ballroom on the top story or the Rathskeller in the basement. But anyway, F. Scott Fitzgerald seems to really have loved the Seelbach so much so that he put it in his most famous novel.
Nice.
The Seelbach Hotel also hosted some of the most notorious names of the early 20th century. During Prohibition, gangsters flourished, building vast fortunes and taste for luxury. The Seelbach was a favorite destination for the likes of Dutch Schultz, George Remus, Lucky Luciano, and even Al Capone.
Nice.
They gathered in the Seelbach to smoke cigars, gamble, and drink. They met in an alcove room off of the famous Oak Room. This room is special. There is a somewhat secret door in one of the corners at the back of the room that leads to a secret passage. This passage takes you past the kitchens, down into the basement, which then leads you to an entrance to the tunnels that span much of the old part of Louisville.
Nice.
So gangsters would gather in this room, which is now called the Al Capone Room, if you were ever to visit the Seelbach. But they would gather in this room, they would have their poker games, and if the fuzz ever showed up, they would just run through the tunnel. They can literally emerge in any part of Louisville, hop in a car, and be miles ahead of the police if anywhere to try to pursue.
That's awesome.
Yeah. There are many ghost sightings in the Seelbach Hotel. One couple was awoken in the middle of the night to see a man staring out of the window in their room. He disappeared as soon as they turned on the light. One of the employees was working in the auto cafe when they caught a glimpse of an old woman in ragged clothes standing behind them in a mirror. When they turned around, she was gone, and there was no one in the vicinity that matched the description of who they saw. So it's not like she walked away. There are sightings of various spirits all throughout the rest of the hotel. Shadows, cold spots, smells, phantom smells, and people vanishing through walls and closed doors. Any of these could possibly be F. Scott Fitzgerald. Maybe yeah. That was him in that couple's room looking out one of the upper floors, getting inspiration for a novel. Or maybe it could have been Al Capone waiting on an old poker match to start up. Who knows? But possibly the most famous specter to haunt the Seelbach Hotel is known as the Lady in Blue. She has become a fixture of the Seelbach, so much so that there's actually an alcoholic beverage named after her.
Sweet.
One of these days I want to make this. It sounds delicious. And I'm not a gin drinker, so that's saying something. But it calls for 1.5 ounces of gin, 1/4 ounce creme de violet, 3/4 ounce fresh lemon juice, 1/2 ounce of simple syrup, 3 drops of orange flower water, blue curacao, there's no measurement on that, and you garnish with edible flowers. The drink is shaken, and the blue curacao is the last ingredient to be added to the shaker in honor of the Lady in Blue.
Nice.
The Lady in Blue is believed to have been the spirit of a woman named Patricia Wilson. Patricia was born Pearl May Elliott in Davenport, Oklahoma. So that's the name that I said shared in common with your story, Pearl.
Yeah.
When you said that, I I kind of got a little, whoa. She was believed to have been born in 1910, but there are also articles that put her year of birth to 1911. You know, they didn't keep the best records back then.
Yeah.
She would grow up and marry a man named Charles B. Wilson, known publicly as L.B. Wilson. Pearl and L.B. eventually separated, and Pearl moved from Oklahoma to Louisville, Kentucky around 1934. She stayed in various boarding houses in and around Louisville, and ultimately she was found dead on top of the service elevator car of the Seelbach Hotel, having fallen down the shaft, falling 6 stories and landing on top of the car when it was positioned on the first floor. They
fell or pushed?
Well, I'm getting to that. The legend goes that she was waiting on her estranged husband to meet her at the bar to discuss a possible reconciliation. He never made it, dying in a car crash on the way to the hotel. Distraught, she threw herself down the elevator shaft. But we don't know for sure. Her death was never solved. What we do know, according to an article on lowkey.com, she was not waiting on her estranged husband. She had told her landlady as she was walking out the door, "I'll be back later, Ma," though she never did return. She left home on the afternoon of July 15th, and her body was discovered on August 7th, 1936.
That is crazy.
By a hotel employee who was cleaning out the service elevator used to transport clean linens to the upper floors of the hotel.
Wow.
Because that was the elevator that they used for the clean linens, it had to be kept meticulously clean, and for the most part, it wasn't a difficult job. On this particular day, there was an unusual amount of dust and even plaster that had fallen inside the service elevator. And a young employee was inspecting it, trying to figure out what had caused this plaster to be knocked loose. When he looked around the edge of the car, he noticed a woman's glove and pulled on it. And eventually went up to the second floor, opened the doors, and found her body
lying on
top of the elevator. She was wearing an orchid-colored dress and white shoes. She had her pocketbook with her, so it wasn't a robbery. And her hat was later found in the hotel's bar, which was at that time called the Stables. Nobody knows how she ended up on top of that elevator car. It doesn't appear to have been a suicide. She didn't seem to be in that type of mental state. She promised her landlady she'd be back later. She had apparently just gone out to run errands and stopped at the hotel bar as her last stop of the evening and ultimately the last stop of her life. But nobody that testified to the investigators remembered seeing or hearing anything that night. So, unfortunately, her death is still a mystery.
That's wild.
Now, people believe that the ghost of the lady in blue is Patricia. She's seen all over the hotel. She seems to favor the 8th floor the most, which would make sense, as that would have been her entry point into the elevator shaft. Sometimes she's seen in the hotel's bar. Sometimes she's seen walking the mezzanine. And most of the time, though, she is seen on the 8th floor in and around the elevator. One hotel employee, the first recorded incident of seeing the lady in blue, a hotel employee saw her walk into the service elevator while the doors remained closed. And then a couple of days later, another employee then saw her walk out of the elevator while the doors remained closed. She always is seen in a long blue dress with long dark hair, although when researching all of the pictures that were associated with Patricia or Pearl, show a woman with a short flapper, not flapper style bob, finger curls bob. And it doesn't look like she has a bun in the back. It very much looks like the hair is cut short, but I don't know. It's hard to tell those old photos. Do you believe the lady in blue is Pearl May Elliott?
It could be.
Yeah. Would you be afraidish if you saw her wandering the hotel?
Probably.
Would you be afraidish if you saw the ghost of Al Capone?
Probably, yeah. So, that's a good story.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Good.
All right, I guess that's it. If you have any stories or requests of anything you want to hear about, or if you know anyone who does, please email us at afraidishpodcast@gmail.com, Instagram and Facebook at afraidishpodcast, and Twitter at afraid_ish. Check out my website, afraid-ishpodcast.com. All the links will be in the show notes. Do you have anything else?
I do not.
All right. And as always, don't be afraid of the dark. Be afraid-ish of what's in it. Bye.
Bye.